Ladies and gentlemen, hyvät naiset ja herrat.
Welcome to the 50th anniversary seminar of the Finnish Institute for Educational Research. Tervetuloa koulutuksen tutkimuslaitoksen 50-vuotisjuhlaseminaariin.
Asetus koulutuksen tutkimuslaitoksen perustamisesta annettiin maaliskuun 8. päivä 1968. Palaamme nyt hetkeksi 60-luvun tunnelmiin suomalaisen kansansävelmän kautta. Tämän laulun uudelleen sanoitti Jyväskylän seminaarista valmistunut kansakoulun opettaja H.J. Erkko.
Ja siihen aikaan, kun tämä laulu syntyi, silloinhan meillä oli Suomessa vielä kansakouluja. Ja tämä laulu oli yksi niistä kansakoulun laulukirjan lauluista, joka oli kansakoulun ihan laulutuntien vakio-ohjelmistoa. Olkaa hyvä.
Ja laulun esittää KTL:n kuoro.
Kiitokset koulutuksen tutkimuslaitoksen kuorolle. Se oli komea esitys ja sopii erittäin hyvin tämän päivän teemaan. Hetken työ 1000 vuosiin vaikuttaa isän maahan ja maailmaan. Tämän laulun viimeinen värssy sopii erityisen hyvin tähän seminaariin, jonka teemana on sivistys, isänmaa ja ihmiskunta. Paljon on muuttunut noista ajoista, kun tuota laulua laulettiin suomalaisilla kansakoulun laulutunneilla, mutta kuulkaapas paljon, se on muuttunut tutkijan työ myöskin noista ajoista. Ja seuraava esitys kertookin siitä, että millaista tutkijan työ on tänä päivänä. Se on kolmiosainen teos, jolla ei vielä ole nimeä, ja arvoisa yleisö, te saatte antaa sille nimen. En kerro siitä sen enempää. Tulkinta on teidän, arvoisa yleisö.
Kiitokset koulutuksen tutkimuslaitoksen henkilökunnalle, joka oli mukana tässä esityksessä. Ja isot kiitokset ja isot aplodit meidän ohjaajallemme Evelina Stolpille.
Niin, tuossa minä lupasin kysyä nyt ehdotuksia nimeksi tälle teokselle ja mitä siinä tapahtui. Kolme osaa. Heitelkää sieltä ihan vapaasti, ihan niin kuin pieniä kiviä heittelisitte tänne. Sanoja, olkaa hyvä.
Se on työn iloa kaikki, työn iloa tuommoinen yhdessä tekeminen.
Kiitos, hieno. Entä ne kolme osaa, mitä siellä tapahtuu?
Ensimmäisessä on myrskyn jälkeen sähköt
poikki. Myrskyn jälkeen sähköt poikki, ensimmäinen
Kiitos.
Osa.
Viimeinen oli maastapako. Hyvä. Joo. Mitäs muuta? Joo.
Mikäs keskimmäinen osa? UFO 3. Erinomaista.
Aivan loistavat otsikot. Joo, kiitoksia. Nyt teoksella on nimi, mutta se oli kantaesitys, mutta se olikin myöskin ainoa esitys. Tätä ei tulla esittämään enää koskaan missään, mutta tallenteena se näkyy vielä tuolla vuoteen 2021 asti ainakin.
Ja seuraavaksi toivotamme Jyväskylän yliopiston rehtorin Keijo Hämäläisen tervetulleeksi pitämään seminaarin avauspuheen.
Arvoisat juhlavieraat, honorable guests, hyvät yliopistolaiset. Täytyy ensin tervehdyssanoja kyllä kiittää kyllä nytten KTL:n henkilöstöä heittäytymisestä ja että osoittaa oikeastaan sitä luovuutta ja rohkeutta, mitä tämä laitos ja tämä yliopisto edustaa. Ja se on juuri tällaista, mitä me haluamme nähdä ja tätä haluamme viestiä. Suuri kiitos siitä. Tämä aina pelastaa päivän, että meiltä löytyy tämmöistä nerokkuutta. On behalf of the University of Jyväskylä, I have a great pleasure to bring my greetings to this seminar celebrating the 50-year anniversary of the Finnish Institute of Educational Research. We are extremely honored today that have our keynote speaker, our honorary doctor, Professor Stephen Chemis, coming all the way from the other side of the globe, Australia, to give it all about the education in Finland and internationally. Tänään juhlistamme 50-vuotista taivalta, ja kun ihminen täyttää 50 vuotta, niin siinä on jonkinlainen semmoinen nivelkohta, ja tulee pohdittavaksi, mitä kaikkia 50 vuoteen voi sisältyä. Kun puhutaan organisaation historiasta 50 vuodesta, niin sitä ei yhden yksittäisen ihmisen ura ehkä kata, ja siinä on useita sukupolvia, joiden aikana sitten laitos uusiutuu ja uudistuu. Kun katsotaan 50 vuotta, niin se ei ole ollenkaan pitkä aika, kun katsotaan yliopistojen perspektiivejä, jotka organisaation rakenteessa säilyttää satojakin vuosia. Mutta jos katsotaan yliopiston sisäisten organisaatioiden elinkaaria, varsinkin nyt viimeisinä kymmeninä vuosina tai jopa kuntien tai valtion organisaatio, niin sisäiset rakenteet muuttuvat selkeästi lyhyemmässä aikataulussa. Erityisesti erillislaitosten, joka KTL on Jyväskylän yliopistossa. Erillislaitot perustetaan usein nimensä mukaisesti selkeästi nouseville aloille vastaamaan ajankohtaisen tiedon ja osaamisen tarpeeseen. Tarpeeseen, jota ehkä perinteisestä yliopiston ainelaitokselta ei löydy. Näin saa alkunsa myös koulutuksen tutkimuslaitos, joka alun perin kasvatustieteiden tutkimuslaitoksen nimellä perustettiin virallisesti 1968, vaikka varsinainen toiminta oli sitä ennen ollut yli 10 vuotta toisella nimellä. KTL on luonut vahvan kansallisen ja myös kansainvälisesti tunnustetun perinteen muun muassa koulutuksen arviointitutkimuksessa. KTL on kestänyt hienossa historiassa niin taloudelliset nousu- ja laskukaudetkin, johon liittyy henkilöstönkin määrän erittäin suuria fluktuaatioita. Ja kannattaa käydä tutustumassa KTL:n sivulla erittäin hienon historiikkiin, joka on myös teknisesti hienosti toteutettu ja voi tutustua erilaisten vuosikymmenen toimintaan. Nykyisellään KTL on kansainvälisesti arvostettu kansallinen tutkimuksen lippulaiva, josta olemme Jyväskylässä erittäin ylpeitä. Erityisen ilahduttavaa on se, että tämän uudisrakennuksen myötä on syntynyt niin sanottu ruusupuistokonsepti, jossa on ainoa aitoa yhdessä tekemisen meininkiä, jossa KTL on vahvasti mukana ja on vahvasti sitoutunut yhteistyöhön yliopistojen muiden tutkijoiden kanssa. Nykyisellään KTL:mme pohjaa toimintansa hyvin vahvaan perinteeseen, mutta samalla myös jatkuvaan uusiutumiseen. Kaikessa ei pidä hötkyillä. Opetuksen ja koulutusjärjestelmän muutokset näkyvät erittäin pitkällä viiveellä. KTL on monessa toiminnassaan rohkea edelläkävijä, pitäen kuitenkin selkeästi fokuksessa myös ratkaisujen löytymisen ja niistä kommunikoimisen selkeällä ja ymmärrettävällä suomen kielellä. Ja tähän löytyy juuri tällä hetkellä yhteiskunnallista huutavaa pulaa, yhteiskunnallista tarvetta. Meillä on Suomessa edelleenkin maailman paras koulutuslaitos. Tämän me haluamme säilyttää. Nyt on kyettävä luotettavasti tieteelliseen tutkimukseen perustuen identifioimaan kaikki ne tärkeimmät asiat, jotka muuttumassa maailmassa tulee koulutuksessa ja koululaitoksessamme säilyttää, mutta samalla kuitenkin poimia ne uudet teknologiat ja toimintatavat, jotka takaavat laadukkaat oppimisprosessit myös tulevaisuudessa. Muutokset kaikesta, myös digitalisaatiosta, tulevat näkymään vasta pitkällä aikajänteellä, ja siksi on äärimmäisen tärkeää luottaa tutkittuun tietoon. Tietoon, jota KTL tuottaa. Olemme parhaillaan Jyväskylän yliopistossa työstämässä koulutuksen lippulaiva-hanketta Suomen Akatemialle. Tarkoituksenamme on monitesti tiivistää osaamistamme oppimisen ja opettamisen alalla ja siirtää osaamista yhä vahvemmin opetusjärjestelmäämme, maakunnassamme, Suomessa ja kansainvälisesti. Tässä osaamiskeskittymässä KTL on erittäin merkittävä rooli. Toivotaan, että rahoituksesta päättäjät arvostavat yliopistojen tutkimuksen yhteiskunnallista vaikuttavuutta muillakin kuin suorilla vaikutuksilla elinkeinoelämään ja talouskasvuun. Työstämme yliopistossa parhaillaan strategiaa ja visiota vuoteen 2030. Kevään aikana olemme kuulleet erittäin laajasti yliopistoyhteisöämme ja sidosryhmiämme. Kerätystä suuresta tietomäärästä alkaa prosessin myötä kiteytyä yhteisömme tärkeät arvot ja yhteisömme tärkeät tavoitteet. Tällä hetkellä työversiossamme missio kiteytyy erinomaiseen hienosti yhteen lauseeseen, joka sitoo myös tämän päivän teemaamme. Olemme vaikuttava sivistysyliopisto. Vaikuttava sivistysyliopisto. Tämä hieno ajatus on saanut yhteisömme erittäin laajaa kannatusta ja hyväksyntää. Nyt katsotaan, kestääkö strategiaprosessin loppuun asti tämä kantaa. Jos kantaa, niin KTL toteuttaa toiminnallaan mitä parhaiten tätä meidän hienoa missiotamme. Näillä sanoilla haluan vielä kerran toivottaa onnea ja menestystä 50-vuotiaalle KTL:lle ja toivottaa kaikille erittäin hedelmällistä juhlaseminaaria. Kiitos.
Kiitos rehtori Keijo Hämäläiselle näistä sanoista, jotka taustoittavat hienosti tätä meidän päiväämme ja sitä työtä, mitä me teemme koulutuksen tutkimuslaitoksella.
Tämän seminaarin teemana on sivistys, isänmaa ja ihmiskunta. Nämä sanat tulevat suoraan Suomen yliopistolaista.
Tämä otsikko on juhlava ja tietysti sopii juhlapäivään. Mutta me olemme kyllä tietoisia siitä, että tässä on myöskin hyvin ongelmallisia käsitteitä. Esimerkiksi, miksi isänmaa? Miksi ei äidinmaa? Tai entäs ne, joiden isät ja äidit tulevat jostain muualta? Onko tämä heidänkin maansa?
Kun puhumme tänään isänmaasta, haluamme sanoa, että tämä on kaikkien maan isien ja äitien, tyttöjen ja poikien maa. Ja ajattelemme, että isänmaa on koko maailma. Tähän ajatukseen perustuu myös seminaarimme seuraava ohjelmanumero, professori Steven Kemisin pääluento. Sen mukaan koulutuksen tärkein päämäärä on tehdä tästä maailmasta elämisen arvoinen paikka kaikille.
Tässä yhteydessä haluan sanoa myöskin pari sanaa siitä, että miksi juuri Steven Kemis on valittu tämän juhlamme puhujaksi. Steven Kemis on maailmanlaajuisesti tunnettu ja tunnustettu tutkija. Erityisesti opettajan koulutuksen puolelta ja myöskin toimintatutkimuksen isänä hänet tunnetaan, mutta tänä päivänä on tärkeää muistaa, että hänet tunnetaan myös laajemmin, nimenomaan kasvatuksen teorian, voi sanoa myöskin kasvatuksen filosofian tutkijana ja asiantuntijana, jolla on hyvin laaja näkemys siitä, että mitä kasvatus ja koulutus on. Yksi tapa katsoa, että miten tutkijan työ vaikuttaa tuolla maailmalla, on yksinkertaisesti tehdä Google Scholar-haku. Teimme sen tuossa tänä aamuna Stevenin kanssa ja totesimme, että tänä aamuna oli ylittynyt 39 000 siteerauksen raja. Ja se on sellainen numero, että niitä ei kyllä ihan kaikilla tutkijoilta löydy. Niin, Steven Chemist tunnetaan siis toimintatutkimuksen asiantuntijana, mutta myöskin laajemmin kasvatuksen teorian kehittelijänä. Viime aikoina hän on työskennellyt käytänteiden arkkitehtuurien teorian parissa, Theory of Practice Architectures. Ja lyhyesti johdattelen teidät tässä siihen, että mistä tässä on kysymys. Aluksi suomen kielellä. Me voidaan ajatella, että koulutuksen käytänteet rakentuvat monella tavalla arkkitehtuurien pohjalta. Ensinnäkin ihan fyysisesti ja materiaalisesti. Ajatellaan vaikka tätä ruusupuistorakennusta ja tätä tilaisuutta täällä. Se, että me istumme nyt tässä auditoriassa tällä tavalla, tai me olemme tuossa jossakin lasiseinäisessä huoneessa opettamassa, nämä asiat omalta osaltaan määrittävät hyvin pitkälle sitä, mikä on mahdollista, minkälaiset käytänteet ovat mahdollisia. Toiseksi, käytänteet rakentuvat myöskin kielen avulla, kulttuurin kautta, mitä sanomme, miten olemme tottuneet puhumaan asioista, eli siellä on hyvin paljon diskursiivisesti määrittyneitä asioita. Kolmanneksi, tähän meidän sosiaaliseen toimintaamme käytänteisiin vaikuttaa myöskin paljon se, minkälaiset valtasuhteet meillä on. Solidaarisuus, lojaalisuus, keskinäinen kunnioitus ja tunnustus. Esimerkiksi opetukseen jotkut tulevat oppilaina, jotkut tulevat opettajina, jotkut tulevat rehtoreina. Ja sillä on väliä, mistä positiosta tullaan. Jotkut ovat mentoreita, jotkut ovat mentoroitavia, jotkut ovat arvioitsijoita ja jotkut ovat arvioitavina. Jotkut ovat tutkijoina ja jotkut ovat tutkittavina. Mutta joka tapauksessa myöskin näitä valtasuhteita voidaan haastaa. Voidaan puhua vaikka vertaismentoroinnista, vertaisoppimisesta, vertaisarvioinnista tai vaikkapa toimintatutkimuksesta, jossa nämä perinteiset roolit sekoittuvat. Kaikki nämä ovat kuitenkin esimerkkejä siitä, miten koulutus rakentuu valtasuhteiden kautta.
But let's now welcome Professor Steven Chemist himself to tell more about these matters. So please welcome Steven Chemist, Professor Emeritus from Charles Sturt University, Australia, and Doctor of Honoris Causa of the Faculty of Education and Psychology, University of Jyväskylä. Please, Professor Chemist, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Rector Keijo Hämäläinen, Director Jussi Levalomaa, Päivi Hannu, distinguished guests and friends, what an honour it is for me to be here on this great occasion for the Finnish Institute for Educational Research. It's a fantastic occasion for you, and I hope I have something to say that will be of interest, but I'm proposing to try and change some ways that we ordinarily think about these questions. So let's see where we go. Whoops, wrong one. Drive it here. Early in the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle explains the purpose of the inquiry he's undertaking into ethics. We're conducting an examination not so we may know what virtue is, but so that we may become good. In this address, I want to encourage you to think the same thing about education in general. We education people not so they may know things, but so they will live well, live good lives. As educators, when we come to develop a new course or plan a lesson or write a lecture, for example, we frequently focus our attention on the knowledge to be taught. So British philosopher Richard Peters, for example, defined education as an initiation into forms of knowledge. By contrast, I want to encourage you to think that education is an initiation into practices. This doesn't mean we give up on the idea of teaching or learning knowledge. It is to say that we want to see knowledge in its context of use. For me, the critical point is that all of what is conventionally called knowledge arises from, recalls, anticipates, and returns to its use in practices. For example, when I was a boy, I learned about constellations in the sky, and it was said that the ancient Greeks and others used those to navigate. I forgot most of what I learned about those things because all I ever learned about was their names. And sadly, I never learned to use them to navigate, and to this day I'm unable to navigate by the stars. Education for knowledge, education for practices. Following notions of practice grounded in the writings of philosophers like Ludwig Wittgenstein, Alistair MacIntyre, and Charles Taylor, Paul Smyers and Nicholas Babulis argued that education is an initiation into practices. They were wanting to argue that to initiate people into practices is not inherently conservative, but it can also lead to progressive aspirations, as, for example, we've all been educated into how to use practices of working online and so on, so we can come to new practices, not only old ones. I want to just say that being initiated into practices doesn't necessarily mean that someone initiates someone else. People can also initiate themselves into practices, as we all do when we learn to use the phone and when we learn to use the new apps on the phone. Nobody teaches us to do it. We stir ourselves into those practices. Anyway, today I want to play with a shift of perspective from education as an initiation into knowledge to education as an initiation into practices. I hope to persuade you that when we make this shift, we see the world of education and educational research slightly differently. So, I've been thinking about practices, well, for a long time, but the last 15 years in particular, influenced by the Wittgenstein, MacIntyre, those others, but also by Richard J. Bernstein, Pierre Bourdieu, Anthony Giddens, Stephen Turner. Then a new generation of practice theorists like Andreas Reckwitz, Bruno Latour, Sylvia Gherardi, David Nicolini, Elizabeth Shove, and others. And I've particularly been influenced by the American practice theorist Theodore Schatzky. When we note the names of those theorists, we've travelled about 70 years. But if we think about Aristotle, we've been thinking about practice for about 2,500 years. And Marx, for example, in the 1830s, writing the theses on Feuerbach, was writing about practices as sensuous human activity and revolutionary praxis. So, about this shift, some people think we live our lives in a stream of consciousness. I think we live our lives in a stream of activities, in a stream of practices that never ends, even when we're asleep. So, to me, life is made of practices. Examples of practices are farming, history, medicine, chess, and education. Others, as we just saw here, writing a proposal, or was it a conference paper, travelling to a conference, drinking coffee, showing your boarding pass, and inexplicably tearing something up. Was it the paper that you gave at the conference that was not well received? I don't know. Practices vary in scale from very large to very small. like asking a question, or very large, like automobility, driving around, as we've done, practices that had to be developed in the late 19th and early 20th century and have spread across the globe. So that practice of driving is perhaps now on the edge of other major transformations, driverless cars and electric cars, for example, that might mean the end of cars powered by fossil fuels. Education is a practice. Within it, we frequently find practices like teaching and learning, and within those are narrower practices like teaching and learning science and teaching physics and learning that equals MC squared. There are macro practices and micro practices and practices at many scales in between. Today, I will define a practice as a particular form of human action in history in which particular activities, doings, are comprehensible in terms of particular ideas and talk, and when people involved are distributed in particular kinds of relationships, and when this combinations of doings, sayings, doings, and relatings hangs together in the project of the practice, which is the ends and the motives, the purposes that motivate the practice. So knowledge has a place in practices, particularly in this definition, in the ideas and talk that make the practice possible and comprehensible, but also in the knowledge which make possible our practical doings, the know-how, and our relatings, knowing how we relate to others. So moving from the view that knowledge is central to education to the view that practice is central to education entails a shift from an epistemological perspective to an ontological perspective. An epistemological perspective puts knowledge at the centre of things. An ontological perspective puts practice and human action in history at the centre of things. The first focuses on knowing, the second on being and becoming. Thus, an epistemological view of education puts the emphasis on what learners come to know, and an ontological perspective on education puts the emphasis on what they come to be and on their becoming. In the first, we're principally concerned with what's in their heads. In the second, we're principally concerned with how they live their lives. We live in intersubjective space. The German philosopher Jürgen Habermas has made an extensive critique of what he calls the philosophy of the subject, or the philosophy of consciousness. For example, he says that the philosophy of the subject assumes that truth is something to be found in propositions that describe or purport to explain things in the world. To use the image from the title of Richard Rorty's book in 1979, this notion of truth sees propositions as a kind of mirror of nature. It's an ancient view of truth, in which propositions in the mind are like images from the world that fall onto our retinas, pass through our optic nerve and are made sense of in our brain. Following Wittgenstein and the American pragmatists, however, Habermas comes to the conclusion that truth can't reside in propositions themselves, nor do they exist in individual human minds. Following Wittgenstein, he accepts that meaning depends on people using language and participating in language games, in which we come to share meanings by orienting to the world in ways that seem to us to be in common. Following the pragmatists, and one might say also from practice theory, he accepts that when we encounter one another in language games and in forms of life, we do so in practice. On the post-metaphysical view of truth that Habermas contrasts with the philosophy of the subject, truth doesn't exist in propositions read off by the mind. It exists in discourse, in dialogue, in conversations, in intellectual traditions, in schools of thought, in scientific disciplines. It exists where we test ideas through communicative action. Truth is not subjective, but intersubjective. I've invited you to think of education not as an initiation into knowledge, but into practices. I've invited you to think of the shift from the epistemological to the ontological perspective. The shift from the subjective to the intersubjective is similar. It emphasises that truth is not just in our heads, but in an intersubjective world we share. It reminds us that we are not isolated, atomistic individuals, but being beings whose knowing and being is rooted in shared language and action and interaction in a shared world. From infancy, we are formed intersubjectively through our encounters with others and the world. We encounter one another and the world as we accomplish things through our practices in a three-dimensional social reality. In semantic space, we encounter one another as interlocutors in shared medium of language. We form our own individual understandings of the world and sometimes arrive at novel insights, but at the same time, all of our understanding is expressed in languages we share. In physical space-time, we encounter one another as embodied beings in the medium of work and activity. Thus, we form our own individual ways of doing things in forms of work and other activities that also frequently involve others, and we do things in a material world that we also share with others. And in social space, we encounter one another as social beings in the medium of power and solidarity. We form our own place in the world in our own special set of relationships with all the others we encounter. But all of those people also exists in webs of relationship of exclusion and inclusion, of hierarchy and equality. So, in practices, we encounter one another and the world in these three dimensions simultaneously, like the three-dimensional intersubjectivity in which we encounter others and develop as persons. Our practices are also three-dimensional. They're composed of sayings, doings, and relatings that hang together in the projects of our practices. And now, to become a little more controversial. Through our practices, I believe, we participate in the community of life on the planet. It is through our co-participation in practices that our encounters with others and the world give us our individuality and uniqueness. At the same time, we're also socialized and shaped as co-participants in a shared world, a shared community, in the words of the title of this seminar, a shared fatherland, but also in the shared community of life on this planet. Indeed, our entire being as individual human beings is a fleeting pulse in the shared and expanding materiality and history of the universe. But I want here to emphasize that we participate in the community of life on the planet through our practices. We eat, we breathe, we move around, we transform things. And as we do, we connect with other people and with a range of other species, from the bacteria that make up our biome to the species farmed for our food to the distant inhabitants of the South American rainforests now under threat by our demands for more farmland, timber, and minerals. Our species, Homo sapiens, has evolved through a dynamic process of reproduction with transformation, that also with selection, that also yielded the differentiation of all species that have ever existed, as well as all the individuals within those species. Our practices also differentiate and evolve through the same dynamic process of reproduction with variation and selection as we interact with others in the world. We make our start in the world with relatively undifferentiated practices like sucking and grasping, and through long processes of differentiation, some under the influence of education, we rise to a vast array of practices in which, as adults, we practice a profession, play leading roles in organisations and communities. Our very selves are woven in and by the practices in which we participate. Our lives are lived in a dialectic in which ourselves generate our practices and our practices generate ourselves, but not by ourselves, because this dialectic is always played out in intersubjective spaces that we share with other people, other species, other things. And if I understood Hanu correctly, he said something about practice architectures. Through lifelong processes of specialisation, the practices of our infancy, childhood and youth differentiate to evolve to yield the rich repertoire of practices by which as adults we accomplish the many and varied things we do. Our practices reach out like tendrils into semantic space, material space, time and social space, and in the process they're shaped and reshaped by the arrangements with which they are entangled. In semantic space, the sayings of our practices are entangled with cultural discursive arrangements in language and specialist discourses that enable and constrain what we say and how we think. In physical space-time, the doings of our practices are entangled with material economic arrangements and so on. In social space, the relatings of our practices are entangled with social political arrangements in power and solidarity that enable and constrain how we can relate to others and the world. Taken together, these three different kinds of arrangements form practice architectures that enable and constrain what we think and say, what we do and how we relate to others and the world through our practices. Thus, for example, my practice of writing this lecture has been shaped by the history of my thought and the ideas and literatures that have shaped my thought through a lifetime. It's shaped by a history of writing, various kinds of academic works and addresses, and by the tools and technologies, including my chair and desk and computer, that have enabled my writing. And my practice has been shaped by relationships with hundreds of colleagues and interlocutors, and in anticipation of this relationship that I am now having with you. But those practice architectures, vast constellations of practice architectures, enable and constrain the way my practice of writing unfolds each time I sit down to write. But our practices are not predetermined by practice architectures. They're malleable. They have a remarkable plasticity. They flow into new conversations with new interlocutors, into new places and times, into new relationships, adapting and evolving in response to the new circumstances and conditions they encounter. Sometimes our practices change readily in fluid adaptations that allow us to continue functioning smoothly in new circumstances. But sometimes our practices are slow and resistant to change. We don't easily give up our established ways of doing things. We see examples of both these tendencies in watching learners learn new practices, sometimes easily adapting to new tasks, and sometimes hesitantly and with resistance. A recent book, Sustainable Practices, Social Theory and Climate Change, edited by Elizabeth Shove and Nicholas Sperling, explores various dimensions of how practices like consumption or transportation have powerful and diffuse effects on the social ecological arrangements that we human beings live amongst. It shows how services like road networks, service stations, car manufacturers and sellers, washing machine manufacturers and distributors, and national power grids powerfully enable and constrain practices for whole human populations. In my terms, these services function as vast practice architectures that powerfully channel practices like driving, laundering, and power consumption. Changing our practices requires more than changing what we do and what we say and how we relate to others. It also requires changing those practice architectures. So, if we have so much invested in the road network, so much invested in coal-fired power generation, we have to undo those things if we want to have other forms of practices. So here's the theory of practice architectures in a picture showing how all of these things relate to one another. I will allow you a few moments to look at it, but I hesitate to pause long. You can have a look at it when we make it available. Okay, so that's the theory. I stand in awe and wonder at the extraordinary variety in the array of ecologically interconnected life forms that currently exist on our planet. Every species in this array has come into being by displacing innumerable earlier species now extinct. There is no way back to our earliest ancestors. Contemporary biodiversity blooms in a soil made rich by the decay of departed species. The extraordinary variety in the practices and accomplishments of human beings is likewise a cause for awe and wonder. All of these diverse practices and accomplishments also come into existence through being nurtured by conditions that made them possible, each in its own ecological niche and in ecological interdependencies that connect them with one another in direct or indirect ways. So contemporary societies across the planet have been composed through human action in history, through dazzling varieties of practices and accomplishments. And as they differentiate still further, an equally dazzling variety of practices is required for their maintenance, their transformation, and their sustainability. Many millions of highly differentiated and specialised practices shared way beyond the village and the globe require human beings to sustain them. And so we must discover how to disperse which practices through human communities and populations, not only for the survival of contemporary societies and economies, but also for the survival of our species and all the other species on the planet on which we depend. Discovering how to disperse these practices through human populations and how to secure them in people and in organisations is an important task for education and therefore an important task for educational research. Through education, we need to initiate rising generations into the vast mix of practices needed for the survival of our communities and the planet. And we need to initiate them out of many practices that currently threaten not only Homo sapiens, but many other species that inhabit our planet. With this image of schools and other education institutions as the purveyors of practices into living human communities and the community of life on the planet, we can sharpen the contrast between the view that schools are transmitters of knowledge and the view that they are purveyors of practices. As I said earlier, knowledge is vitally important, but it's important because of what it does, not what it is. We shouldn't fetishize knowledge. Instead, we should grasp how knowledge has its place in the living world. To reiterate, all of what is conventionally called knowledge arises from, recalls, anticipates, and returns to its use in practices. Knowledge may be essential for practices, but practices are essential for living, for life, because it's through our practices that we participate in the community of life on the planet, for better or for worse. While we may be reluctant to call breathing a practice, it's by respiration that we engage with the air around us. Through practices of eating, we engage with the food we find or grow or buy. Through practices of working, we engage with the economy, and so on. And the ways we do these practices are crucial. It's with good reason that some paleontologists call our era the Anthropocene, the era in which humankind and its practices will bring about one of the greatest extinction events in the history of the planet. It's through our practices of living that all of us engage with and transform the resources of the planet, with effects that ripple through all the rest of the community of life that also depends on this planet. We learn knowledge not for its own sake, but for how it enables us to live with others and in the community of life on the planet. We learn things not only to contemplate them, but also to become good, to make things, to do things, and to consider how things might be otherwise or better for people. Education has the double purpose of forming individuals and forming societies. On the view of practices I've outlined, I see education as initiation to practice, but the practices into which people are initiated through education are ones intended to be for the good of the person being educated in the justified self-interests of that person. Not only this, they will also be practices that are simultaneously intended to be for the good for humankind, justified in the interests of all. Encapsulating this view in a slogan, one might say that education aims to form people so they can live well in a world worth living in a fatherland worth living in, and in the community of life on the planet worth living in. I don't have time to elaborate this, but I'll just say a little bit about how education achieves, contributes the good for humankind. First, it promotes and enhances individual and collective self-expression. Thus, it works to secure a culture based on reason. Second, it promotes and enhances individual and collective self-development. And thus, it works to secure a productive and sustainable economy and environment. And third, it aims to promote and enhance individual and collective self-determination, and in this way it works to secure a just and democratic society. These, it seems to me, are three crucial elements of the good for humankind in a world worth living in. Taking these ideas about the good for humankind into account, we might say more precisely that education is initiation into practices and thus into forms of understandings that foster and sustain individual and collective self-expression, modes of action that foster and sustain individual and collective self-development, and ways of relating to others that foster and sustain individual and collective self-determination. And by doing these things, serves both the good for each person and the good for humankind. Now, I put this view of education together with the theory of practice architectures to produce a theory of education grounded in practices, as opposed to grounded entirely in knowledge. Now, I'll just say a very brief... you'll see that picture later. A brief word about educational research. I've sketched a theory of practice and a theory of education. What are the purposes of educational research? I think the purposes of educational research are simply to make the practice of education more educational and less anti-educational. It's a big job. In terms of making education more educational, educational research might help us more richly to achieve the double purpose of education, enhancing individuals' opportunities and so on, not only in our nations but own nations but across the globe, securing cultures based on reason, and productive and sustainable economies and just and democratic societies. In terms of making education less anti or non-educational, educational research might help us as far as possible to remove from schooling those practices that distract schools from the central task of educating students, and especially those that are contrary to the purposes of education, practices that make it harder for learners to achieve individual collective self-expression, self-development and self-determination. Many practices in schools have these effects, like forms of classroom management that limit learners' freedom of expression, that demean or discourage students, or that limit learners' freedom of association. Educational research might helpfully identify where such practices are to be found in schools and how they might be replaced with more educative practices. On the view that education's an initiation to practices, educational research might be needed relating to each of what Basil Bernstein called the three message systems of the school. And I'll say to pass quickly through this section, in relation to curriculum, we might be thinking of how we can move from curricula of knowledges to curricula of practices. What might curricula of practices look like? How might we see ourselves as producing practices in students, not just recitations of knowledge? What forms of teaching and learning are going to help students enter not just knowledge, but to enter into ways of doing things and practices? What forms of evaluation and assessment will allow us to move from assessing knowledge to assessing practices? For example, there was an attempt decades ago to have a competency-based movement, which seems to me to have some intuition similar to this idea of seeing things done in practice, but it somehow diminished practice and reduced it to small elements of competencies that didn't actually achieve it. I think more is being done in workplace learning now that might be more satisfactory. I'll leave that speculation for now and pass on. We're at a crucial turning point in the life of our planet and the species that inhabit it. We need to think of the planet not as a backdrop for human life or simply as a resource for humankind. It's a community of life of which Homo sapiens is a part. I've suggested that it's through our practices that we're intertwined with other species in this community of life, and through our practices that we engage with the dynamic chemical and geophysical processes of the Earth itself, including, but not only in relation to, the processes by which global climate change is occurring. Human life is conducted in practices. We're not the sole or autonomous producers of all of our own practices as individual people, but co-producers of practices in concert with others, in the languages and cultures, the economies and environments, and the communities and societies that we inhabit. Humankind faces multiple and compounding challenges in the Anthropocene era. Our current ways of life threaten rising and future generations, not only of Homo sapiens, but also many of other species that are becoming extinct or threatened with extinction at an unprecedented rate. Our ways of life are made up of practices that must change if we and many other species are to survive and thrive. I look at my grandchildren with shocked to think of the tasks that we're leaving them as a consequence of our use of the planet. Once upon a time, education could concern itself principally with the distribution of knowledge through populations. In those innocent days, nature seemed inexhaustible. Now we know better. Now we can see that many of our historically given, culturally formed practices are extinguishing many of the resources necessary for human life and threatening many other species besides. But we can also see that it's through our practices that we're engaging with those species in the planet. We can see that our webs of practices are part of the whole web of life on the planet. It's not just through our biology, one by one, that we participate in life on Earth, but also through social practices, distributed differentially across the whole population of Homo sapiens. If we think about the tasks of education and educational research from a practice perspective, we may be able to identify the kinds of practices we must curb and extinguish if our species and others are to survive and thrive. Education and educational research can help us to replace destructive practices with ones that are more likely to secure the sustainability of our species and other species, and to limit existential threats like those posed by rising sea levels, warming and more acidic oceans, warming air and land temperatures, more extreme weather events, and the mass migration of human beings caused by climate change and by the conflicts that migration is likely to generate. The great conundrum of our time is that we have the science and we have the knowledge that allow us to conclude that these threats are upon us. But this knowledge has not been sufficient to change our practices on the scale necessary to decisively avert the existential threats we face. Some of this knowledge is being put into practice in changes in our use of fossil fuels and for energy and transport, for example. But more changes in practice are needed on a global scale. Is one of the reasons that more of that science has not been put into practice because we've been satisfied with education as an initiation into knowledge and not as an initiation into practices? Have we been satisfied that people know the science, even though they've not transformed their lives to live differently on the planet? Every one of us has to make this transformation in our practices, in our lives, not just in our knowing, but in our being and becoming. Accomplishing the necessary changes in human social practices and distributing new practices throughout human populations are not just challenges for politics and policy. They require intimate changes in practice for all of us and on behalf of rising generations. Changing the practices that currently constitute our world and replacing them with more sustainable practice is the central challenge for education and educational research in our time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Kemis. This gave us plenty of intellectual nourishment and food of thought. Thank you very much.
Voidaan tietysti myös kysyä sitä kysymystä ihan aiheellisesti, kuten on jo kysytty, että miksi englanniksi puhe tässä suomalaisen koulutuksen tutkimuksen suuressa juhlassa? Ihan yksinkertaisesti siitä syystä, että hyvä tutkimus on sekä kansainvälistä että myöskin paikallista ja kotimaista. Tähän kaikki tämä perustuu, tämä meidän työmme. Tämä puhe tullaan julkaisemaan koulutuksen tutkimuslaitoksen verkkosivuilla ihan tänä päivänä, joten olette erittäin tervetulleita jatkamaan sitten tämän asian miettimistä. Ja tosiaankin professori Kemis on täällä vielä ensi viikolla meidän kanssamme myöskin, ja muun muassa sitten täällä Ruusupuiston laitumille laskiaisissa voi olla mahdollisuus sitten jatkaa keskusteluja. Tämä teoria käytänteiden arkkitehtuureista on todellakin, voi sanoa, että se on tämmöinen uusi teoria, voisi sanoa emerging theory of practice. Ja siitä on jotain julkaistu jo suomen kielellä, mutta siitä tullaan julkaisemaan lisää. Meillä on nimittäin Stephen Kemisin kanssa tarkoitus kirjoittaa tästä myös suomeksi. Stephen on, kuulkaa, hämmästyttävän hyvä kirjoittamaan suomen kielellä juttuja. Varsinkin jos vähän siitä ei tule siis missään tapauksessa käännös, siis tämän esityksen käännös, mutta tästä esitelmästä tulee hyvin paljon olemaan vaikutteita siihen, mitä meillä on tarkoitus kirjoittaa ja julkaista lähiaikoina. Toivottavasti eräässä tunnustetuimmassa suomalaisessa kasvatuksen alan julkaisussa, jota voitte kuvitella, mutta koska sitä ei ole vielä hyväksytty, niin ei sitä sen enempää. Toivotaan, että reviewerit on myötämielisiä. Näin, ja nyt meillä on sitten, kuulkaa, semmoinen hämmästyttävä tilanne, että me ollaan aikataulusta edellä, mikä on todella hyvä uutinen monestakin syystä. Ja tietysti myöskin siitä syystä, että varmaan jo kahvihammasta pakottaa. Ja tuossa kahvitauollahan on myöskin sitten mahdollisuus tavata tuttuja, jutella sekä tästä esityksestä että muista tärkeistä asioista. Ja sitten tuolla kahvitauolla on myöskin esillä koulutuksen tutkimuslaitoksen visuaalinen historia, johon jo rehtori puheessaan viittasi. Ja siellä on myöskin tutkimustiimien esittelyt sitten tuolla screenillä, ja voitte näihin tutustua sitten tuossa kahvitauon aikana.
Mutta ennen kuin mennään kahville, on vielä mahdollisuus, jos joku haluaa esittää kommentteja tai kysymyksiä professori Kemisin luennosta, niin nyt on pieni hetki aikaa.
Olkaa hyvä. Suomeksi tai englanniksi?
Yes, I'm Matti Savolainen, I'm a senior researcher from this institute. Very excellent presentation, but only one comment. As you know, in Aristoteles we have three elements: theoria, theory, praxis, and poesis. What is poesis? It's production. And these elements means that the praxis you are using is two different kinds: the praxis of politics, society, and praxis of production. And I think this is very important from the whole the cultural history of Europe, of this division. Thank you.
Will I respond? Yes, please. You're quite right, of course. Aristotle made that distinction in the Nicomachean Ethics that I spoke about. But the production of the poesis refers to the production of things, whether they're poems or motor cars, and praxis refers to the production of history and the production of persons. And both of these things are essential, of course, but how we do poesis is a crucial question now for the world. And we've lived in a world where one might say the way of thinking of poesis has led us to a point where our mastery of the world is in fact threatening it, and we need to, one might say, also think how we can practice production more wisely.
Kiitos. Thank you, Matti Vesa, for a very good question indeed, and thank you, Stephen, for your answer. And there seems to be another question.
One question. I'm photographer okay. Petteri, and I like your conclusion about practices. We all know that eating meat is a sin. We all know that flying is a sin. Still, we do not change our practices. When do we change our practices? When it's too late?
I think the answer is what you said.
Thank you. Something else? Oh, there are more questions. Okay. You're very welcome to ask and comment.
Thank you very much, Professor Kemis, for your talk. This is more just a comment, not a question. I'm involved in transnational education, and there are a lot of questions related to these issues, being involved in teaching in different cultures and different societies. I think that a lot of what you said here today resonates on many of the things we have had to deal with, and we are happy to think about. But when we talk about practices, I mean, you're not saying exactly what the practices should be. It's as theoretical model shouldn't. But these are the practical questions that come after practices. That what are the what should be the good practices, and how do we implement what practices, and where, and with whom, and how? it's something that is really, really interesting and important to think about.
I know you said it's not a question, but a comment, but I would say in response that while, as in the case of justice, it's very hard to say what justice consists of, it's much easier to say what injustice is. And if we work against injustice, we can maybe build a more just world. But if we work against the practices that are killing us, it may be that we don't have to find the perfect practices, only start to get rid of the ones that are destroying the possibility of life on the planet.
Thanks. Some other comments, questions, thoughts? Well, I think that's more or less, we're more or less happy with this. Thank you very much indeed. And remember, Stephen Kemis will be around here tonight in the reception, and next week in so many places. We have a couple of seminars here, and we also have this Ruusupuiston Laitumille laskiaiset cruise, where Stephen will be also around. And I think the best discussions are maybe somewhere else than in these kind of auditoriums. So I think it's really time for a coffee break, is it?
Kyllä. Ja nyt näyttää siltä, että kahvipöytä on siellä valmiiksi katettuna. Olkaa hyvät, hyvät naiset ja herrat.
Jatkamme ohjelmaa merkittynä aikana, eli kello 14. Tässä tavataan taas. Olkaa hyvä. Thank you.
Thank you.